This is Geek Speak for Saturday, May 2nd, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm geek translator Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me today in the studio, as we broadcast live from 7th Avenue, is Lyle Troxell, software engineer, maker, father, and photographer.
Hello.
Good morning, Lyle.
Good morning. It's nice to be live here.
It is. Yeah, it feels good. Especially because we get to talk to Dr. Don Motyka, of course, of Ask Dr. Don on KUSP, but also a functional medicine and integrative primary doctor in Santa Cruz. Welcome to you, Doc.
Hi there. Great to be here.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking about geeky things, medical things, and the place where those things meet, as well as some just stuff. I wanted to start off because last time we had a show, Lyle, we just started talking right at the end about teeny tiny computers.
Yes.
And then we ran out of time.
Yes. It's and I had this great collection of information about these microcomputers that exist. Yeah. And they're not as small as I want them for my sci-fi fantasies to become realities.
We're not having the incredible journey inside the body.
No, I mean, we definitely have small computers that go in the body that is fascinating. But Michigan Micromote, this small MEM, the small electronic device, has been released as a platform. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because we have other content on the show today to talk about. Okay. The reason why I'm so excited about it has to do with some sci-fi that talks about these microcomputers. I mean, so
our sci-fi fantasy is in some way becoming a reality.
Yeah.
The future is now.
Exactly. So Vincer Verney, who wrote A Deepness in the Sky and a few other books, has this amazing futuristic world. But one of the things he talks about are the small computers the size of the grains of sand or dust. They actually float in the air that are networked together. Oh. And with these, they all have a little bit of sensing. If it's a mesh network and they communicate relatively well, you can glean a lot of information about how the world works. And in this book, which I highly recommend, The Deepness in the Sky, another of his series, he goes into like the craziness that you could achieve if you had computers everywhere sensing you.
Okay.
Lots of sci-fi artists like this,
sure,
this idea.
Yeah.
So these grains of sand are not, I mean, these micromotes are actually about the size of a piece of rice, a long grain rice.
Okay.
So they're floating in the sky.
No.
But imagine.
But birds could still eat them and bloat after their wedding.
Yes.
Okay.
So imagine we have, you throw a computer in the tip of your faucet in your kitchen or anywhere in your water flow.
Okay.
That always senses what is in your water. Now, in a commercial water system, we have places that we sense the water. People actually manually do it. Sometimes there's electronic sensors that are integrated. Mm-hmm. But we don't do it at the house level, right?
Right.
The reason we don't do it at the house level has nothing to do with whether it's possible. It has to do with the expense of having some system that senses your water real time.
Yeah.
But as these computers get small enough and therefore cheaper, it becomes less of an issue of whether you should have one or not, and why wouldn't you have one?
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, the faucet that you buy at the store will have one of these computers built into it. It will connect to your Wi-Fi, and it will tell you not only how much water is going on, but it also might tell you the temperature. So let's say, for example, over the use of your 3 weeks of using your kitchen, the system finds out that you never actually use the hottest setting. In fact, never the faucets have the hottest setting. Therefore, let's reduce the temperature of your water system, because then you're going to save energy.
Yeah, so then sensors can talk to the device itself, right? And it can help save you some energy costs.
Yeah, but the point of it is that you don't know what the system will be like in a world that has these small computers everywhere. And that's the benefit of it. Now, there's a lot of privacy and concerns as well.
Sure.
Don?
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to comment about an obvious use for this, but it's at the other end, so to speak. And that's the smart toilet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because think about this. In a person, we have an epidemic of diabetes going on, and many people don't have a clue that they're at risk. This is particularly true, by the way, of people who are whose ancestors, their parents, grew up in South Asia, like Pakistan or India, because these are the people who will have normal weight and a normal diet and will become pre-diabetic without having any clue whatsoever that this is a problem. It's an epidemic, yes.
Oh,
it's a huge epidemic. Something like 30% of average weight 30-year-old computer geeks over there in the Silicon Valley who have Pakistani or South Asian ancestry show signs of early pre-diabetes.
Oh, that's different from how I thought diabetes worked.
Well, we'll come back to that. Yeah. But the smart toilet, you see, is going to smoke that out.
Right.
Because it can check your blood, or excuse me, it can check your urine glucose. You're not supposed to have sugar in your urine. Yeah. But if your blood sugar goes above 170, which it never should, unless you're pre-diabetic, then it could register in the smart toilet.
Right. So what you're saying is that one thing to do is to tell everybody to go to the doctors, get a urine sample, and get tested. And do that, by the way, make sure to do that every 3 or 4 months.
But you're going to miss that.
You'll totally miss it. And you're not going to get everyone to do that. And the systems in place would be insane. But you put a $2 sensor in a toilet that can do that, and all of a sudden, your house is telling you you've got a problem.
You went out, you had, you know, the Haagen-Dazs moment, and, you know, we're watching the movie and went through the whole pint of ice cream. You know, I've done that. And then that night, you go to bed and you pee, and your toilet tells you, you're spilling glucose. You need to go see the doctor. Mm. That kind of early warning signal for lots of things would just be hugely beneficial and cheap.
And those systems exist. Toilets exist. Like, the patent's been around for a while. There's been toilet talk of this kind of sort since 2009.
Toilet talk. Is that the same as potty mouth?
I don't know.
Slightly different.
And the truth is, the reason why it's not everywhere is because it's more expensive. But as the price drops, it will just be integrated. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see bathroom scales now at the same, a little bit more expensive, that connect to your Wi-Fi and log your weight over time, which is useful. The whole point of these things, though, is that the only way we get to a point where it's kind of ubiquitous and we catch more people before they get really sick is by getting that price point down, so that why wouldn't you put a computer in it? Mm-hmm. And the privacy thing is always there as well, of course, because now if your toilet has a vulnerability, other
someone
people can know. Someone can hack your toilet and know what's going on with your body. But also
content of my poo I consider to be private information.
Could you program in a reverse flush maneuver, though?
And you can also imagine that at an airport, like a large facility that has bathrooms, some company comes in and says, hey, we'll redo your entire bathroom, putting sensors everywhere, and all we need is a flat screen when you leave the bathroom, right? So now some company senses and says, hey, you're pre-diabetic, you should try this medication, right? Starts advertising directly to people because they just sense their body. Now, that's a little wrong, right? And so then we're going to have policies and rules about what you can sense inside a waste system that's in a public venue without notifications. Rises, of course.
It does, and doesn't it seem sort of inevitable? I mean, everyone's so charmed by the Internet of
totally
Things.
Inevitable.
We're headed there anyway. We might as well prepare for our dystopian future.
I don't know. I don't think it's dystopian if it's, hey, by the way, if you do a slight change to your diet right now and do a little bit of health, you're going to live another 20 years because you're not going to get diabetes. Like that, I don't know if that's the kind of scale. But
all right. So here's my counter argument.
All right.
You know how you're at work and no one does the dishes. And so, you know, some person who's tired of doing them for everybody puts up a sign that says, your mother doesn't work here. Please do your dishes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, people talk about it and it's effective for a little while. But in fact, there's still dishes in the sink. And so then she puts up another sign, you know, like, seriously, you guys, do your dang dishes. And so, you know, then you get sort of
a barrage,
a display blindness,
yeah.
You know, like all that display doesn't matter anymore because people just learn not to pay attention to it. Wouldn't that be possible also with this, you know, with the being told all the time that you really should go to the doctor?
Yes. So now you have an LCD on top above the sink, and there's a genome sensor in the drain.
Yeah.
And anybody that doesn't get their genetic data into that sink every once in a while gets put on the board of warning, you're not washing dishes. So, you know, it could be specifically targeted to the person that's doing the deed.
All right. So it might be effective in the shaming of people into doing the right thing.
Because I can imagine just washing your hands in the sink every once in a while. Anyway.
Just to kind of prevent yourself from having to.
So that's why I'm excited about microcomputers, because of as the price reduces, we get to see them in more places. And that has benefits and, of course, also has drawbacks.
Yeah. Now, nanotechnology is already in place in a lot of medical settings. Isn't that true?
Yes. There's many ways that it's being used, particularly in cancer therapy. One of the stories I covered a couple of months ago was the very interesting property that gold nanotubules have. So if you make little tubes of gold, they hone in on cancer cells.
What?
Why? They just do.
They're just the right it's shape just or the molecular
thing.
Shape
it's
or something?
It's just a thing. And it's a...
So one of the things that's interesting about cancer growth is that it is normally faster than the rest of the growth of the body. So more blood flow is going there. Like, it's one of the target centers, right, for cancer, is that it needs more. And therefore, you put small particles and more of it are going to show up there.
That's
than
true, too.
In the
so
body.
It's sort of a filtering phenomenon. That may be the entire mechanism. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that gold nanotubules are tubules. They're hollow. You can load it with chemotherapy agents.
Cool.
And so you can selectively deliver the chemo agents to the cancers. And you don't run into the problem that with trashing the intestinal tract that you run into with most chemotherapy drugs.
Oh, because it goes just where it needs to be.
It just
doesn't leak all over the place.
Yeah, it doesn't leak all over the place.
I mean, you then also have a whole bunch of little gold tubes around the cancer site?
Yeah.
I guess it's better to have that than having living cancer.
Right.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. And probably this particular application is really, it's at stage 3 right now.
Oh.
So it'll be out and out. Going soon.
Really cool.
Oh my gosh.
So the other ones that I'm familiar with, of course, are all these probes, right? Small cameras that you put into a person's body.
The pill cam.
Yeah.
Well, yes. And then, of course, we could talk about the Da Vinci robo surgery thing, but maybe we'll save that for
a future
show. But the pill cam, a device in search of an application. Sad but true.
I dressed up and there to go.
That was going to be my take on that as well.
Well, first of all, there's the recovery problem. So they finally got it. That was a problem.
Well, describe what it is.
Yeah, well, it's a small little macroscopic, but little, and you can swallow it. It's a camera.
And it looks like a large pill, mm-hmm. transparent pill that you get out of a pill box, right? It just has electronics
in
it instead of medicine.
And it
doesn't break down in your digestive system. That shell is going to survive.
And it goes all the way through you. And this first was developed about 10 years ago, but it didn't get any commercial traction because it was an extremely expensive device. And you were losing 50% of them.
Because of flushing.
And that was not the skin flushing.
Right.
But anyway, people were oops, no, there it went.
Oops, yeah. There's $10,000.
Yeah.
But it's gotten
so
cheaper.
That didn't work. So now they're cheap enough that if you flush it, it's no big deal. They're considered disposable and semi-disposable. Anyway, the bottom line is... If you'll pardon the pun. The fact is that you get these pictures. They are telemetry, so they come out, they get broadcast to a receiving device. You can watch what's going on in the intestinal tract. But the problem is the polarity can't be established. You don't know which way it's facing. So, whoop, there went the tumor. Well, let's see.
It's somewhere.
We're at mile 53.
Yeah.
Which is not how you're going to do the surgery. You don't need to know how far it is from your mouth,
so
right?
You need to know where. Basically, what we need is a little bit more AI in there so that it drops some kind of marker. When you hit a button and somebody would stand there and basically if you see something that you wanted...
I'm assuming you could do this inside a scanning device too where the entire patient's inside the scanner. But this is
the resolution on the scanner. Remember, the gut... We're talking small intestine here.
Right,
Because we can't
it's a lot
get... There's, 24 feet of small intestine all mushed up like a bunch of spaghetti in a... the mile 53 is sitting right next to mile 10.
Right, you have no idea.
And if the walls are right there next to each other and in any kind of whole body scanning device, you don't know whether you're at mile 53 or mile 10. And furthermore, mile 53 and mile 10 are not going to be touching
now,
tomorrow.
From a confirmation perspective, if you can see a site that's like a problematic in the small intestine, then you know potentially you're going to have to go in there. And when you open the body up and see... the intestine from the outside of the intestine, if you will, inside the cavity, you might be able to see it or not.
Yeah, that's the problem.
So that's really the issue. All right.
Yeah, if it's a massive tumor that, is bulging the wall,
then
you can
know.
See it.
But the whole point is to catch it early, right?
Yeah.
So, but...
Like I said, device in search of an application, if we can get the marker technology so that we drop a marker, something we can pick up...
Or even a small computer that stays there.
Yes.
Of course, you have to attach the wall.
It could have babies. It could be little subcomputers.
You swallow mouthfuls of small computers, and they just kind of hang around. All right.
I don't know. We could also consider, genetically, maybe we can genetically manipulate intestinal parasites to home in on cancers or something.
It's definitely the kind of thing we're researching all the time,
that's
for sure.
Well, so this is the first of, we're hoping, many instances of Dr. Don coming to visit us to talk about how geekery and the medical industry connect. So if you would like to ask a geek-related medical question for future segments like this, then you can communicate with the show. One way you can reach GeekSpeak is via Twitter. We're at KUSP Geeks. That's all one word. If you have questions or comments for us, you could send us a tweet. Or you could also reach us on Facebook. We're also KUSP Geeks on Facebook.
That's true.
You could email us at geeks@geekspeak.org. These are all ways that you could submit ideas for us to take up in future shows. You're listening to Geek Speak here on KUSP. Another fine show on KUSP, aside from Ask Dr. Don, is the Seventh Avenue Project. This week on the show, how did life begin? How did dumb molecules get together and create living things? A new theory by MIT biophysicist Jeremy England has been getting a lot of attention in scientific circles, and he's even been called the man who may one-up Darwin, though he says that's a serious exaggeration. Anyway, he talks to Seventh Avenue Project host Robert Pauly about the journey from matter to life and from physics to biology, and you can hear that tomorrow at noon on KUSP, or anytime you like, just look for the Seventh Avenue Project in the talk section at KUSP. org. Right now, you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch. With me in the air studio is Lyle Troxell and Dr. Don Motika. And earlier in the show, we talked about ransomware.
Yes.
This is a particularly hideous form of malware where your information gets locked down. The evil baddies have the key. And if you want to see your stuff again, you better pay them up.
You got to get that key.
Yeah, so you can get the key to unlock your data.
Encryption methodology where they don't actually have to take the data off your computer. They just encrypt it and they keep the private key and then you pay them to get it back. And it's been very effective. The story we talked about was a police department, mm-hmm. actually a whole county with four police departments having to pay the ransom.
So bad. And awkward, right?
Oh, yeah. A little uncomfortable.
Anyway, it's been happening across the world. And in the Netherlands, the police there have teamed up with Kaspersky Labs and have figured out how to decrypt some of the keys. Particularly used by CoinVault. That's a ransomware campaign. And they are offering their decryption keys and a decryption application for free, anyone who wants, at their website, which we will link to from geekspeak.org. So,
and to be clear, they didn't actually backwards hack this thing. They didn't try to figure out the keys. That's not what they're doing. They're actually breaking into the computers that are holding the keys and taking them offline and going in there and getting them, and then they publish the private key.
Right.
So it's very much like the you know, the robbers are storing their stuff somewhere, and the police force are just finding where they're found. Which I guess they've got about 720 of these keys.
Yeah.
That's 720 people probably saved by not having to pay the ransomware. So.
Right, yeah. So it's noransom.kaspersky.com.
Or also at geekspeak.org.
Or at geekspeak.org. And so if that's something that you're suffering from, or if you just want to make a little bookmark in case you suffer in the future, you have a resource there. Hey, it could happen.
It could.
All right. So that's ransomware. Now, it's Dr. Don, you had a question. We were talking earlier about phone apps or the smartwatch.
Exactly.
Medical and applications.
Exactly. Well, I'm a little skeptical. Yeah. And I'm actually, you know, this is the show's Ask Dr. Don, but I'm going to ask your audience to get back to us with their experience and perspective on this. My own experience with several devices. First of all, I should say that I have cold hands. And so the pulse rates that these devices tell me I have are incorrect. I mean, I'm sitting there looking at my pulse rate, and it's telling me that it's 60, and it's actually, you know, 76.
You're putting your hand to your carotid artery, which is your neck.
Yeah, my carotid artery.
Hopefully that one's pretty accurate.
Accurate.
It's not, you wouldn't be thinking as well as you do.
So,
so we're talking about pulse sensing on wrists.
Not so good.
Yeah.
The devices at the gym, you know, where you grab the
two different prongs.
How accurate
those are. Those are pretty bad. At least I think they're probably normalized for the classic 70-kilogram male, or maybe now it's the 80-kilogram male, given, you know, we have
our progress,
people inflation.
Yes,
but it's not accurate, demonstrably, for this particular. I don't know what I am, 58-kilogram female. Mm-hmm. So,
And that's because you said you have cold hands.
Yeah.
Meaning that you're not getting the same pulse rate, or do you think that the blood flow is so restricted it just can't sense it?
I think it's that. I think that that there's a threshold effect with the pulse.
Yeah. So let's talk about the different ways of sensing pulses. I thought we'd just talk about from a technical perspective how you actually do it.
Yeah, how does that work?
Yeah, so the electronic one I'm not going to get into because it's a little more complex, but let's talk about the optical. How you actually do it optically. You've probably put in hospitals, you put a sensor on someone's finger that wraps around their finger. It has a light on it, normally is red. Mm-hmm. Anybody you've seen in a...
Pulse oximetry,
yes. And pulse oximetry actually works by... It's pretty interesting history. It was developed in 1972. And what you're doing there is you're shining a light through the tissue of the hand and picking it up on the opposite side. And first, let's talk about pulse sensing, just the pulse rate, not the oximetry, because the oximetry, of course, is actually the oxygen level. Would you agree?
Yes.
Oh, good. I got it right.
Yay. Yeah, it's the percentage. It's basically a back calculation. Hemoglobin has a different optical quality if it's got oxygen in it or if it doesn't.
And we know this because when someone is starved of oxygen, what color do they change?
They turn purple.
They turn purplish. They're actually turning blue because blood that doesn't have oxygen in it is blue colored and blood that does have oxygen is red colored. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that is how the oximetry works. You shine a light through it. In fact, you shine two different colors of light. It was first developed with red and infrared. And the amount of light that's absorbed by those cells that do not reflect back tells you a difference on how much oxygenated blood you have versus non-oxygenated blood. But to do this, you have to get a computer involved because just having two different voltage levels, which the meters have, doesn't give you enough. So then you put an algorithm on top of that that says, well, the rate, you know, it has some logic to it. That's a big part of why these things work at all. But you also know, so that's the amount of blood level. The general sensing of what the pulse rate is should actually be a lot easier to do because there what you're doing, you're just looking for a signal of change and counting the change. Movement is also a change, though. So if you have someone with one of these sensors on and they're moving a lot, you're going to get other rate pulses in there, if you will, or lack of pulse reads. And that's just about looking at a sine wave, a kind of sine wave. So I agree that in general, probably the best way to do it is go through the skin. But you'll notice on like the Apple Watch, it doesn't have a through. It doesn't throw light through you. In fact, instead, it just bounces light off your tissue. There's lights on the back of the device.
Oh, okay.
And when they recently did a teardown, iFixit did a teardown of this device, and one of the things they found is, it looks like though Apple's not telling anybody, they have an oximeter in the device. And the way they thought was, I mean, the reason why you can tell that is they have two different colors of light, because you need two different colors of light to get the differential. But Apple's watch is doing refraction. They're actually doing reflective qualities of the blood, which is not going to be, I believe, as good as going through the blood flow. Because let's say your veins are thinner. You're going to get refraction from the beginning of the vein, but the thicker it is, the more blood there is there, and the less refraction to get deeper in. We go into why the sky is blue kind of thing. This is the same type of concept.
It's how the light refracts.
Yeah. So Apple actually has bright green LEDs in this thing and an infrared LED. And so they have a larger spectrum of difference of absorption of the green versus reflection, because a green light, of course, is not going to reflect off of blue, of red cells. That's the reason why things are red. The light that is the color that you don't see is being absorbed. Mm-hmm. Now, this all takes a lot of power. But the thing that Apple does have on one of these devices, any watch, any kind of powerful watch or powerful computer has, is more time to calculate meaning. Because that's what it really is about.
So that's the advantage about having a resident advice living there over a long period of time. It's on your person, and so it can just make its calculations in its own time.
In fact, that idea of it being on you for a long time and doing it regularly is what I think is more valuable than actual correct meter readings. And that's what I wanted to ask you about, Dawn.
Because you can corroborate
readings. The Apple Watch 2 will undoubtedly have learning software that will allow it to adapt to the characteristics of the individual and change its settings, but they'll hold that one back for the next release.
Right. In fact, they're even holding back the oximeter. They're not talking about that either, even though it's in there. And they're probably not talking about that because they probably don't have FDA approval on it yet. And my thought is that they won't release that until they have FDA approval, or they will just offer the API to researchers that put applications on the app and not claim that it's an oximeter or anything, mm-hmm. but give access to it to certain bodies that will then potentially use or not. No. The question I've got for you, though, if you if I'm your patient and you know my heart rate is exactly 75, something like that, when I do certain things, is that more important, or is it better to know over 5 years, all of a sudden in this period, my heart rate increased by 5% all the time? Wouldn't that be more valuable to you as a medical profession?
Well, we don't really think in terms of the average heart rate itself as having much prognostic value, because where I do see, for example, the Apple Watch having, you know, enormous Big Brother implications is when you see something you like. There's two things that happen. Your pulse speeds up and your pupils dilate. These are as a result of it.
Other things happen too, but they're more internal.
Well, that's one kind of like, but I'm even thinking about maybe that new shiny geek object that you want to purchase. You'll get some pupil dilation. That could be read off of the
camera,
you know, camera looking at you. But your watch could also tell the store that you like that one.
Right.
And so, you know, there's another commercial application there is selling your information. You should probably read the privacy agreement that comes with that Apple Watch very carefully.
Right.
But I think that the key thing, what I would love to see from a clinical standpoint, and this could do it, is beat-to-beat variability. So really quickly, the space between your heartbeats tells a great deal about your health. If you have a certain kind of really erratic space between your heartbeats, your chances of having a cardiac sudden death are much higher.
And this is not pulse rate, because pulse rate, you measure for 15 seconds and you multiply it.
It's the first derivative of your pulse rate, if you will. So it's the distance between each heartbeat. And in a healthy person, let's say you take someone who's meditating, you know, who's an adept meditator. If you measure the space between their heartbeats and you graph it, what you get is a slightly increasing and then a slightly decreasing. It turns into a sine wave, very nice regular sine wave.
Yeah, to be clear, it is a derivative function, meaning that if you count the amount of beats in 1 minute, the person's heart rate's whatever the heart rate
60.
Is. That's what we normally talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you can measure it, as a human being can measure by counting. But if you instead look at the duration between, the spacing out, you'll see that that varies over a period of time. And that variability actually tells about the health.
Yes. And if you've got a nice even variability that's reproducible and
consistent throughout the day kind of thing.
Consistent throughout the day or more consistent, then that is an indicator that has, you know, enormous prognostic significance. And in people who have, let's say, recently had an MI, if we had a device that we could strap to them and just monitor them as they leave the hospital and go about their daily things, we'd be able to figure out who's getting into trouble, who's recovering, who's at serious risk and maybe needs additional medication to stabilize that heart rhythm so that they don't just grab their chest and drop dead.
And in fact, this is sometimes why you keep a patient in the hospital, just to get that data, right?
Yeah.
Because you want to know how are they doing, how stable are they after the point. And then once you see those signs being stable, you can release them to the wild. So potentially less hospital stay if you had trust. Trust is a big issue, though, of whether it's going to work or not. And let me just say that the Apple Watch, it would be trivial to get the spacing information. Like, that's part of what they're capturing. That's
no problem. That's why I'm excited about it, is that you could also hook that into a biofeedback loop. So, for example,
I could see how I'm doing,
and there are very easy things that you can do that a simple computer app on your phone could coach you to actually
improve. It's time to sit down, or it's time to stretch.
Or more along the lines of deep breathing, breathe in, breathe out, show you a picture that you've already, that it knows will improve.
So I can imagine.
Show you a picture of your dog or your daughter.
Right. I can imagine a whole room full of people watching a movie, and then the surprise happened. The cat jumps in front of the camera, and everybody watches, goes, beep. Okay, breathe.
We'd have to disable that.
You know?
It'd be the new sound of fear is just people's Apple Watches going off.
Yeah.
Like how the car alarms go off at the earthquake.
Yes. I love it.
So that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that because I didn't know that was an important aspect of the heart rate. But this is also like the heart murmur. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about where there's an inconsistency?
No.
This is really just rate.
It's actually a noise.
It's
a sound caused by turbulent fluid flow across a valve.
All right. So the last question, though, about whether it's accurate or not. Of course, if you get that kind of information, you need it to be accurate for you to get the data you need. The amount of heartbeats per day or if it's doing that well. The thing about sensing information is the accuracy is is debatable, because what's the truth accuracy, right? I mean, mm-hmm. the pulse rate in your extremity is going to be different than right from the heart, because there's friction in the flow of your tissues. Your tissues expand and contract. So your heart rate and your pulse rate at your wrist are different things. So when you say, because there are different locations, right? This is all about, like, there's even quantum effects about this, where you can't get know everything, right? You can't know all aspects of a system. Mm-hmm. So accuracy is a mythical thing in some ways, but change and the understanding that something's different now is not. So if I take a Apple Watch and I wear it on my wrist, and I pretty much wear it all the time, and I don't put like an opaque tattoo between me and it, and then over a month we look at my data, if something happens, if I start dieting poorly or some other choice occurs or something serious happens, we'll see a change happen in there and go, oh, we need to go in and look at, you know, we need to see a doctor.
Yeah, and it needs to be interpreted. So, for example, in your scenario, let's suppose that there was your average heart rate went from 60 to 80. Now, the implications for that in a sedentary individual are that something's wrong. Maybe they are having night sweats. Maybe they're having wake-ups, their sleep is disrupted.
But if I just climb three stories?
Bingo. If you take up exercise, your average heart rate over a month is also going to change.
Yeah.
So I think it's in its infancy. The idea of being able to measure and study this, particularly with crowdsourcing, if enough people submit their data so that it can be crunched, mm-hmm. and we can look at other health aspects through time, it may have unexpected predictive value. And that's really, from my standpoint, the brave new world here is, can it help us save lives? Can it help us catch disease early before you need a liver transplant?
And, you know, the more data we collect at this kind of level, if we get a lot of participants, the more we're going to know if it's useful, right?
Yes.
And my optimistic technology perspective is it will be really useful. It'll be an amazing effect. But we might not see great uses out of it for the first couple of years.
I just wish that the companies who are introducing this would put in that little thing, privacy thing that nobody ever reads, that we are going to take your de-identified data and we are going to play with it.
So I can talk about what Apple has said publicly about that and one of the things they're doing. They've had this app kit thing, which is a software package that deals with your medical information, mm-hmm. not app kit, med kit, I can't remember what it's called, health kit. There you go. And one of the things they did early on was really frustrating to me. You can just tell your backups of your iPhone to be encrypted or not. You can do that on your device or you can do that in the cloud. And basically that means you put in an extra password. No one knows that password but you. And it uses that password to encrypt the data on your computer. I did a shortcut recently before I went to Europe last year, and I didn't encrypt my backups. I just backed up. I was in a rush and I upgraded my phone and then I restored from the backup. And all my health data wasn't there anymore. It was really frustrating to me because I'd had all the step information that I was interested in. How many times I work on a third floor, and so I was kind of making sure I walked up and down a lot, and I wanted to see over time if that helped me. Well, all my medical information was there. So I looked it up, and Apple said, we will not export your health kit information, that data, unless you have an encrypted file. We're just not going to support this data being out there. Yeah. So from a step of like kind of being annoying, they're taking the let's be private and irritating more than make it easy. And I like that stance. That showed me
they
care about that being private. The other aspect is they say they're not, that stuff is not leaving the watch unless iPhone, unless you explicitly approve an application to do so. So Don, if you wanted to do a study, you could write an application or a group could write an application, then request people to give this heart telemetry information to your system, and people explicitly have to say, yes, I want to give this information to that test. And Apple is putting in place an anonymizing piece in there so that you don't get who that person is, but you do over time know it's the same individual. So they're doing the right steps, I think. Mm-hmm. And this all has to do with trusting Apple's, like what Apple's saying. So there is an unknown there.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm sort of curious about how this technology was formed. Like, who thought of the idea of having our phones and our watches be a place where medical information can be collected toward the greater good?
Science fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah, really. I mean, that's where I come down, because when you books from 1960 and above are talking about a world where computers are helping all the time and the systems are keeping track of people, right?
Yeah, and so then in practical terms, did sci-fi inspire software development? Did sci-fi inspire doctors to talk to tech? You know, like what?
I wish I could remember the story. There's a great story about the flip phone and whether whether Star Trek detected the flip phone would exist or the flip phone existed because of Star Trek, and we'll never know the coupling, which one is true.
Chicken egg.
But I think that a lot of people in the tech industry do a lot of reading of science fiction.
Yeah.
And so you're going to see most of the time the analogies come from that flow.
Yeah.
But whether it's inevitable or not without the artist thinking about it first
is
unknown, I think.
So then I guess there's also a question about how much conversation is happening between the medical industry and the people who are making these apps and such, so that they are as useful as they could be.
Well, you can look at probably the main doctor writer on this is Eric Topol, who has written extensively about disruptive technology, and he's from Scripps in San Diego, and very smart man, and is clearly one of the people that would be the, if you were going to develop a device,
he'd be the person to talk to. Yeah,
he'd be the guy that you'd want on your board of directors because he is very incisive, and I really enjoy what he has to say about these things, although he's very gung-ho, and that's fine. You know, it's a spectrum of attitude about this. I wonder what, and this is a question for the audience. I'm interested in the pedometers and how accurate they are. Mm-hmm. How they, maybe you can tell me
how they work,
the wrist-held, the wristband ones. How accurate are they in terms of distance? Do they couple? Are there any that couple with heart rate so that we are sure that you're just not in a bumpy, that you're not just in a bumpy vehicle going over bumps as opposed to taking steps?
Yeah.
It's Geek Speak here on 88.9 KOSP and KOSP.org. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle Troxell and Dr. Don Motikin. We were just talking about pedometers and how they couple with heart rate detectors.
I'm so frustrated that all these bands that people put on their arms are called pedometers, because pedometer comes from steps, right? And it's a meter of step. Mm-hmm. But these things are not metering your steps. They're metering on movement.
Yeah.
And so it's not a pedometer.
That's what I wondered. How does it measure steps?
So if you, there's a few, I linked earlier to you kind of an analysis of some of these, right? Pedometer review, top reviews, I don't know, we'll link it to geekspeak.org. And it's just a chart of all these different ones. And the one that's winning, you'll notice, Don, if you see the picture of this, the one that's winning is one of the Fitbits, but it's not a wristband. It's a little dongle. And specifically, it's a dongle that goes on your hip, because if you want to measure gait, your hip up and down is much better than either your foot, which, you know, you sit in a meeting and you tap your foot. But it's actually hard to kind of move your hip without walking around, unless you're maybe dancing. But then again, you're still moving.
That's still moving. That counts.
Hip movement seems like a better way to go. So this pedometer, which kind of wins it, I think it's actually from Fitbit. You have to wear it on your hip.
We
it's
might
a little
be able to teach men to dance.
That would be good. And so the other thing I want to say is that stepping and heart rate, I guess the best way to do all this would be to have a sensor on the hip that also checked your blood flow in your hip area. Hard to do, though, because the artery is kind of low, which is good because hitting that's dangerous. But that would probably be the best thing, you know, that you could get your heart rate and everything. But you'd have to strap something right to your leg. If you're in a situation where your health is extremely important, that's probably the best kind of tech to get.
Yeah.
But if everyone, you know, if 80% of the population in the U.S. gets something that they wear and it's not as good, that's probably better to get the mass data. So the pedometers, how accurate are they? They're not if you're wearing them on the wrist. At the same time, you know, I talked to you earlier, Don, about the idea of difference over time. Unless you're all of a sudden doing a lot of hand gestures in your speaking, if you change that pattern, then your step count's going to change. But if you live your life and you wear it on your wrist and you do a lot of hand gestures, and then one day you do a 4-mile walk and the next day you talk and then you don't do the 4-mile walk, the difference will probably just be representational about the walk distance. Like, and that's what you want to do, is get people's walk distance up. So I think it's probably a good feedback mechanism for people to change how much they move, but it's not representational of how far you've traveled or how far you've walked, right?
One of the things we'll have to adapt out is that we currently have this 10,000 steps sort of, you'll
target.
Be healthy if you do 10,000 steps, and unless you talk with your hands, in which case you might have to do 15,000 steps.
Right. Yeah, and that's the thing is I feels like having any kind of target on these devices that don't actually count steps is really bad. Like, you shouldn't even show the step count to people. You should do something else. Now, the secondary thing that occurs is most of the phones in your life have GPS. And so you can definitely imagine a system that uses GPS and steps, and then you know how far you've gone.
Mm-hmm.
Also in duration. So if you've gone on a 4-mile hike and your step count was X and you weren't talking the whole time, shaking your hand and doubling your rate, then maybe it's useful. And the other aspect of this is that your gait of walk is relatively stable. You know, a group of people will get to one gait and they'll move that way for a long period of time. And you should programmatically be able to sense that kind of movement versus hand gestures, which is much faster. So there's definitely an ability to get some data out of it. But accuracy, again, is not what these things provide. They provide feedback for people to change how much they move or talk
with
their
hands.
There's
nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
And actually, I will say that I have been impressed at the number of patients of mine who've come in wearing these that I've inquired, mm-hmm. and they've definitely expressed that, I have to get my steps in today, you know, because all I've done is sat around. This one woman's a dental hygienist that I had this most recent conversation, and all I've done is, you know, clean teeth all day, and I need to go get my steps in. And it's for her become kind of a body hygiene, you know, being mm-hmm. dental hygienists have a certain attitude about flossing, and she's taken that attitude about flossing, and now she's flossing her legs.
Yeah.
Basically,
yeah.
Walking.
So then the pedometer becomes less useful for measuring at the wrist, but more useful as kind of like a string around the finger.
Yes.
As a reminder of what you're up to.
But here's
a motivator. It's a motivator.
It's a motivator.
It's a motivator for her. She sees that she hit her benchmark, and for her, that's a little squirt of dopamine in the mm-hmm. back of the brain. And
good
that's
for you.
That's what we want.
And the good thing is that it's on you all the time. You don't forget it. And that's one of those things about wearable tech, that it should be so much a part of your life that you don't have to go, oh, now I'm going to work out. Now I'm going to put the Fitbit on today. You know,
please make them pretty?
I wish they were pretty. So let me just tell you guys, you don't have an iPhone. You're an Android person, right? You have an iPad.
I like to think of myself as a human being.
I love it. Bonnie, you have an iPhone.
Yes.
So when you pull your iPhone out, do you put it in your pocket or do you put it in your purse?
I put it in my purse because I got the 6 Plus. It's too big.
I know.
You don't want it in your pocket.
I know, except that it has a pedometer in it, a movement sensor.
You don't want it in your pocket.
And if you wear it in your pocket, it's on your hip.
Yeah.
And it's moving, and its step rate is pretty good. It's actually recording your step rate. The reason I wanted to have you pull out your phone.
Do you want more children?
Well, I want to talk about the pedometer aspect first, and then we'll talk about the cancer product. So what I'm saying is you didn't even know, Bonnie, probably, that your phone is actually counting your steps all the time.
It claims to, but because I put it in my purse and I put my purse down, it's useless to me.
Mine works pretty well because I put it on my hip.
Uh-huh.
And so I do get a count that represents my hip movement.
Well, you
and
have
the
all
amount
the
of times
want,
a day
right?
I pull
so
my...
That's okay.
I already have my 3 kids. Exactly. I don't need any more children.
So wait until you have your kids.
Are there studies showing that electronic radios in your pocket are problematic for cancer?
How about reducing your sperm count?
It does, in fact.
Biological effect. That's been pretty thoroughly documented.
How do we know that?
Measuring sperm counts
in people that have
who carry
phones that
their
don't
phones
have phone?
In their front pocket and
versus
then
back
having
pocket?
Them stop doing that and then measuring their sperm counts later.
Oh, okay. Pretty good.
You know, it's not placebo. It's mm-hmm. case control. Mm-hmm. Well, no, it's not case control.
No, because you didn't give them fake phones.
Right.
But, they know that anyway.
So, okay, there could be placebo effect on sperm count.
What kind of effect are we talking about?
I don't remember. I'm sorry. It's been, I'll come back with that next week.
Next time. Of course, okay. We know that heat definitely has effect.
Right, and we know that this heats tissue.
Right.
And so that's...
So it might simply not be about the cellular stuff, but about the heat stuff?
Well, there's enough studies on electroporation and other things to suggest that actually what's happening is that you're affecting the mitochondrial gradient. So you make energy by building up an energy gradient. So you put negative charges on the outside of the mitochondria, and then you let them trickle through. And as they trickle in, you grab that gradient and turned it into ATP.
Okay.
If you make holes in the membrane, it's leaky, and so you lose your gradient.
So why would radio frequency stuff do that?
Because they
from a chemical perspective,
electromagnetic fields have effect on physical objects,
and these things are polarized.
These are basically lipid bilayers, so they're fluid,
mm-hmm.
but they're a fat bubble, right?
And
that's
they
what
have
cells are,
and they have polarity.
And you punch holes. No, it's the actual wave going through. As I
so
understand,
the wave has no physical quality in that sense. It will move.
But
it will cycle.
The membrane has polarity because it has proteins in it.
Right.
So
okay.
what you
so
do
it's the
is
protein
you create,
particles that are being shifted by the magnetic field.
It's the pebble in a pond effect. Okay. Mm-hmm. You drop a pebble in the pond, you get ripples.
Yeah.
Those ripples affect the permeability of the membrane temporarily. And then it goes back. But if you keep shooting pebbles through the membrane, you've got a vibrating
choppy
membrane,
water.
Which is choppy water.
This, of course, is our best guessed as because the study showing the study the output study.
Right. So Manuel Beltran has written us on our Twitter feed, and he says, "Well, there are foot pods that measure foot movement."
Yes. Yeah. The problem with the foot pods, in fact, one of the first pedometers that was kind of mass scale, it was actually for the iOS. It was Nike and iOS merger. You put it in your shoe.
Uh-huh.
The issue is that you'll actually notice your feet move a lot when you're not walking because you'll put your leg on
your meeting and you're tapping
and
your
tapping foot. That's really what I was talking about. But if you put that sensor in your tennis shoe, you're going to get a really good run sensing, and that's a great thing to do. If you wear it all the time and you shake your foot a lot, you get the same problem as the hand gestures when you're speaking, but not as much probably.
You know, you could do something that was linear in a foot in a pad and then just look at heel strike
sure.
roll forward, and you never do get that when you tap your foot.
But then again, you don't get the same sense when you jog. So, but yeah, there'd be more information actually about like whether your gait is appropriate for your movement speed and stuff as well.
Might be hard to get that down to that price point that you were talking
about. And that's
about
the thing, is let's say that's a $20 item. But if you're going to buy a watch anyway and it has something in it that's almost as good, it's probably better to do that because then everybody that has the watch has it as well rather than just the people that are interested in the run sensor in your foot.
The foot pod's more specialized.
But I'm interested in people's personal experiences, you know, whether
okay.
they found it to be helpful, you know, their story, because I, like I said, I'm just interested. I don't know if I should be recommending these things to my patients.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm interested in your listeners' opinion.
So Twitter, KUSP Geeks. I think most people are more Facebooky, and so please feel free to follow us. We're facebook.com/KUSP Geeks. Don, you have a Facebook page as well?
Yes, I do. It's Ask Dr. Don.
Ask Dr. Don. So we're available. Just follow us and ask us questions there.
I'll have to start looking at it
now. I know. Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, really. You know what we'll do is we look at that stuff, and I'll ping you anytime you get interesting stuff going on that could be good for the shows.
So, let us know what your experience is with these devices. Which ones do you use? What do you think about their accuracy and their utility in your life? And then we'll collect up the information that we gather and do a little follow-up report here on GeekSpeak, and also share that information with the good doctor here so that it can be discussed on a couple of programs.
Sounds good.
Yeah. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. We're just going to switch in this short time we have left from medical geekery to entertainment geekery. and I want to talk about how content is filtered. How do you select content and, you know, what happens with
it? It's actually kind of a lead-in discussion about copyright we're going to talk about a bit.
Yeah.
Right now, if you upload a video to YouTube and that video has a song that's a very popular song in the video and you're not the YouTube account of Sony Pictures that theoretically owns the rights to reproduce that song, YouTube will automatically mute that soundtrack on your system.
Right.
If you make a video clip that is a perfect replication of some television show, YouTube will find it and remove it.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that happens has to do with content ID and massive amounts of processing power going and looking at all videos. It's not a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And the problems with these systems, of course, is that they can be mistaken. If you are the owner of the footage and then the television station broadcasts your footage, and then they put that up, you can lose your copyright on YouTube because they rebroadcasted your, you know, it's a clunky system. It's a clunky system.
Yeah.
We don't really have a better one. One of the things that YouTube does is they really want to explain this to you. So they've got a whole bunch of help files I found fascinating about how their system works. They describe technically how do they compare videos, and they also describe how you say, make a claim and how you fight a claim. And it's a lot of work and troublesome, but interesting read if you're interested in that kind of content about copyright. One of the things I find interesting is the way people get around this. If you've ever found a YouTube video of something you wanted to look at and you've realized halfway through that the whole thing is flipped from
it's
the
reversed.
XY.
Yeah,
it's reversed. Something. That's one of the ways to defeat the system.
Well, that's what that's about.
But once people do that enough, YouTube adds that. Google adds that in the system, so it's that learning curve, of that hacking curve
it's
that emerges all the time.
Cat and mouse game that happens.
Sometimes you'll find like a Colbert Report that will be a YouTube video of a television in someone's house with a cat in front of it, and in the television is the YouTube video, actually edited post, so it's still pretty clean. The reason they're doing that is for the content filter as well.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Huh.
I just thought that was interesting.
I wonder how that affects people whose sort of creative form is the supercut.
Oh, like the Daily Show and Colbert. Are you meaning like using other people's content?
I meant that just on like YouTube, right?
Okay.
Like, here's a supercut of all the dudes walking away from an explosion because they're so cool, right?
Oh, right.
So then, you know, how are those allowed to stay up versus...
Yeah,
there might be a duration factor.
It's a duration.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's this kind of... there's a general zeitgeist that people feel like if you play 15 seconds of music on a podcast, it's not copyright infringement, it's fair use. Duration's actually not one of the fair use rules, but the general concept is, if you're not, if most of your content's not that, you're not really making money from that segment, and therefore it's okay to use. But that's really the idea behind that, has to do with you're referencing it rather than you're using it as your entertainment factor.
Right, which does happen a lot on The Daily Show. It used to happen on The Colbert Report, now happens on Last Week Tonight. And it turns out, I was surprised to find there's like a nice intersection between my interest in comedy, I'm a comedy geek, and my interest in tech. And there's this thing called Snapstream, which is apparently, you know, if they've hyper-referenced all kinds of clips, like you could search for tons and tons of Fox News programming and find just the clip you're looking for that points out the hypocrisy of what they said last week versus what they said 5 years ago. It's a common trope you see on The Daily Show. So it turns out this thing is called Snapstream, and they've recently released a version that's available for people who are not producers on those shows. So if you're curious about how all that works, we'll have a link to it at geekspeak.org.
So the interesting thing is, it's a piece of hardware that you buy. So one of the issues with this... Oh, look at that. We're running out of time.
Oh, my gosh. We're going to have to talk about the copyright aspects at a later time. This has been Geek Speak for the 2nd of May, 2015. This is public radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, and live online at KUSP.org. A Geek Speak, by the way, is a registered service mark of David Lawrence, and he's used with permission. And Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so please reuse our stuff any way you like. Just cite your sources like a good citizen. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. See, that's how you do it. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle Troxell and Dr. Don Motika. Thanks to our intern Chandler, our Canadian correspondent Greg Merkley, who visited us very briefly after some sort of emergency at the casino where he works, apparently. Anyway, thank you for being here for Geek Speak today, and we'll talk to you again.
Hey, Don, thanks for being here. It was awesome.
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah, thanks so much.